You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week of August 21, and it's podcast number 54. I'm Joe Elia. Next week, there won't be a clinical conversation. I'll be on vacation, like many of you. Back to this week's agenda. This week, we talk with someone whose findings challenge established dogma on elective induction of labor. Nope. Elective induction doesn't increase the risk for cesarean delivery, according to this meta-analysis. Here is a brief look at the other principal clinical news of the week first. More details are at podcasts.jwatch.org. Prescribing heroin to patients refractory to treatment was associated with better adherence to rehabilitation programs and a drop in criminal activity. However, the complication rate was such that the treatment, administration under medical supervision, is likely to be used only in the most refractory cases. The study appears in the New England Journal of Medicine. Next, there's a new booster shot available for Haemophilus influenzae B. It's to help kids who deferred their booster shots because of the vaccine shortage of the past couple of years. Next, contrary to worries, the HPV vaccine Gardasil seems about as safe as other vaccines, according to a federally funded study reported in JAMA. Finally, a Chinese herb known as Thunder God Vine, or Lei Gong Teng, offered better symptom relief in rheumatoid arthritis than sulfasalazine, according to an Annals of Internal Medicine article. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Elective induction of labor is no more likely than expectant management to be associated with cesarean delivery, according to a meta-analysis published this week in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The analysis looked at randomized trials comparing induction between 37 and 41 weeks with expectant management. Those induced at 41 weeks had a lower risk of cesarean delivery or meconium-stained amniotic fluid, but before 41 weeks, the difference was not statistically significant. There's dogma at stake here. The common belief is that induction increases the risk for cesarean delivery, but the evidence doesn't support the dogma. We've asked the first author of the meta-analysis, Dr. Aaron Coy, to discuss all this. Dr. Coy is an associate professor and director of the Fellowship in Maternal-Fetal Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Welcome, Dr. Coy.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How do you think the dogma took root? You give an interesting explanation of it in the paper. Could you?
Yeah, I actually don't find it. I don't find it surprising that people think that induction of labor is associated with cesarean delivery. At my heart, first I'm a clinician, and in clinical practice, if you take care of 100 women with a spontaneous labor, and then you take care of 100 women that have an induction of labor, the women who are induced will have a higher rate of cesarean delivery, probably about twice as high. So as a clinician, just from your own practice, it would appear that induction of labor would be associated with a higher rate of cesarean delivery. The next thing is that our literature in obstetrics and gynecology, the vast majority of it is observational studies. And there are literally hundreds of papers that look at predictors of cesarean delivery or factors associated with cesarean delivery. And in all those observational studies, induction of labor, again, is associated with cesarean delivery. Now, methodologically, why is that problematic? Well, fundamentally, if you're taking care of someone who's pregnant and you get to 39 weeks or 40 weeks or even 41 weeks, at any given point in time, your decision isn't either should I induce this patient today or have her go into spontaneous labor today.
Right.
But it's should I induce her today or let her become pregnant till tomorrow or and beyond. And that's wherein lies the methodologic component that a randomized trial will appropriately capture. That really the appropriate comparison group when you're studying this is induction of labor versus expectant management of the pregnancy. And we first tried to look at this using observational data. About 2 years ago, we published a paper in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and we compared women who were induced at a particular gestational age, say 40 weeks of gestation, and we compared them to all women that got beyond 40 weeks of gestational age. And we found when we made the comparison that way, a lower rate of cesarean delivery in the women who are induced. So that plus then a number of prospective randomized trials that find similarly either no difference or a reduced risk of cesarean delivery in the women who are induced really do substantiate this idea.
How closely held is this dogma? Do you, if you were to stop 10 colleagues in the Carter today, do you think they would all be believers in this? Or since they're your colleagues, they may not be, but is it widely held?
That's a good question. I think it is actually widely held. What's interesting about that question is that that many things in obstetrics and gynecology, we say, oh, if you ask 10 providers, you get 12 different answers. And I actually think that if you ask 10 people around the country in obstetrics and gynecology, midwifery, maternal fetal medicine, family practice, I think 9 out of 10 or greater would probably think that adductional labor is associated with cesarean delivery.
Yeah.
Now, you're right that people that know me and have heard me give, say, talks on this topic, they would say, well, there's this guy out at UCSF, and they would explain the idea that when you actually compare inductional labor to elective expected management of pregnancy, that indeed it does appear that there's either no difference or reduction in cesarean delivery. And I will tell you that when I give some grand rounds and CME talks on this, and I have a lot of clinicians come up to me afterwards, the people that are really interested in this idea, I think they've been thinking about it and been puzzled by the idea. Mm. And I think that more and more they're getting that this actually does make sense. And fundamentally, it makes sense also because, again, as a clinician, you think, well, gosh, in labor, there's only two reasons really to have a C-section. One is if the baby doesn't fit, and two is if the baby doesn't tolerate labor, right? You know, other reasons like whether someone has a outbreak of herpes or a preview or a breach really has nothing to do with whether they're in labor or not. So those two reasons, babies don't fit, babies don't tolerate labor, those both only increase when you increase the gestational age of a pregnancy. In other words, babies only get bigger,
right.
They're less likely to fit.
Mm-hmm.
And placentas only get older become more senescent.
Mm-hmm.
And so if an older placenta is less likely to tolerate the contractions and the decreased blood flow during contractions of labor. So if you think about it, expectantly managing a pregnancy, if you had the ability to start labor, should only increase the risk of C-section. Now, the balance of that, the trade-off of that, is that when you do an induction of labor, you might have a C-section for a failed induction.
Uh-huh.
And so that's always the trade-off. And so if in your practice, when you start an induction of labor, you end up with a failed induction half the time, well, then, yeah, induction of labor in your practice is going to be associated with C-section.
And you may not be inducing right.
We find that, well, I wouldn't say not inducing right. I would say oftentimes it's the inappropriate establishment of expectations in both the provider and the patient.
Okay.
In other words, you say to somebody, okay, let's say so I run the diabetes practice, for example, at UCSF. And so we end up inducing a lot of women at 39 weeks of gestation. So if I said to them, okay, let's schedule a date, and they said, okay, September 1st, and they show up at 8 a.m. on September 1st, if I haven't talked to them about the process, then oftentimes by 5 p.m., 10, 12 hours later, mm-hmm. they're kind of wondering where the baby is.
Uh-huh.
And instead, what we do is we talk about the fact that it can take a day to 2 days just to ripen the cervix.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll spend 24 to 36 hours just using prostaglandins and a Foley bulb to get someone in the cervical ripening,
mm-hmm.
Basically kind of through the first part of latent phase. And then we recognize that the rest of latent phase can take another 12 to 24 hours, that you won't get someone into active phase of labor sometimes until 2 to 3 days out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this means, of course, patience on the part of both of the provider and the woman herself. And if you don't go into that process with appropriate expectations, it's just easy to call it a day.
Yeah.
In the setting of elective induction labor, since you're only doing it for kind of usually social or schedule reasons, well, I would say that another option to kind of inducing until failed induction labor is you do an induction for 18, 24, 30 hours. Mm-hmm. And if there's no change in the cervix, then why not call it a trial of induction and the patient can go home and wait 4 to 5 days and see if, the cervical ripening will be achieved during that time.
Yeah.
And we do a trial of induction once every about once a week or so, easy as that feels like, where someone will come in, they'll spend overnight. By the morning, nothing's really happened. We'll say, well, you know, I want to wait till next week. And this seems to, again, you can't do it once they're already in the hospital.
Yeah.
You have to establish that plan, those expectations, while you're in the clinic, and say, this is an option.
The editorial that accompanied your analysis says that the evidence that you present, or the evidence that's available, doesn't answer the burning question. And the burning question is, what about induction between 39 and 41 weeks? Do you agree that the evidence isn't there?
Oh, I think that's entirely correct.
Yeah.
There's in our analysis, in our systematic review, where we reviewed over 3,500 papers to cull out these randomized trials, there were only two in the English literature that have examined induction of labor prior to 41 weeks of gestational age. Of note, there is one other paper in the French language by an author, Beart, B-E-A-R-T, who has also looked at this before 41 weeks of gestational age. In a Cochrane review that incorporated all three of those papers, there was a statistically significant reduction in the risk of cesarean delivery in women who were induced between 38 and 40 weeks and 6 days. But again, that's from papers from the 1970s, 1980s. None of them conducted in the United States. None of them conducting under our current climate and our current practice styles. So I would entirely agree with Dr. McCone's editorial that we just don't have enough evidence. And certainly this area is ripe for future study.
So I would imagine that there will be more papers coming on that, and those papers, if they're carefully designed, are going to answer important questions, aren't they?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We have a couple of analyses going on currently using both the national birth cohort data as well as some other birth certificate data. Now, of course, the problem with this is, you know, that birth certificate data is very good for telling whether a baby was born by cesarean delivery or not, and is very good for a few other predictors, maternal age, race, ethnicity, education, but is less good in culling out the women who, say, had an elective induction and certainly has no information on whether or not they had a ripe cervix, for example, when they were induced, you know, whether cervical ripening agents were utilized, that sort of thing. So while my group is planning to generate a number of other papers using observational data, what really we need is a large, multi-center prospective trial in the U.S.
And there isn't one on the boards that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. Of note, I have a colleague at the University of Pennsylvania, a guy named Jim Nicholson, and Jim is a family practice doc who, about 15 years ago, while he was just working as a clinician, began realizing essentially the same thing that I've been thinking about for a decade, which is that, you know, babies should only have C-sections because they're too big and because they don't tolerate labor. And he started a protocol where it's a very thoughtful kind of preventive, you know, founded in the tenets of and principles of preventive medicine, that he induces people a number of days earlier if they have a variety of risk factors. These are risk factors either for a baby being too big and not fitting, or a baby not tolerating labor. So, for example, someone who has chronic hypertension would get induced a little bit earlier. Someone who's short, less than 5'1", would get induced a little bit earlier. And his protocol is called AMOR-IPAT, Active Management of Risk in Pregnancy at Term, AMOR-IPAT. And he's published a couple of papers on this, including a small randomized trial. And in AMOR-IPAT, you know, he'll end up inducing 50-60% of the patients and finding a lower rate of cesarean delivery. In his observational studies, the rates of cesarean delivery versus expected management have been 2 to 3 times lower. In the randomized trial, it ended up being 10% versus 15%, so about a third lower, but wasn't quite statistically significant because of power issues.
Yeah.
So this trial, you know, we're planning, he and I have been planning for about 3 or 4 years to do a multi-center prospective randomized trial, and we're hoping at some point in the near future that the NIH will fund such a trial. Meanwhile, we both have IRBs approved at our respective institutions to look at this protocol and are trying to even recruit without a lot of funding to get this work done.
Yeah.
We have a number of other sites that are interested in doing this, And it, you know, and even without funding, Jim has been explaining these protocols to a number of centers around the country, and a couple of them in the Northeast, I understand, have actually taken this on and are doing this. It's a very thoughtful way to think about it, that, you know, that the vast majority of women can proceed on to 40, 41, maybe even 42 weeks of gestational age without there being a difference in the risk of cesarean delivery. But if your risk, a priori risk, is higher to begin with, that inducing earlier probably is beneficial.
Well, maybe some of our listeners will get in touch with you at UCSF and express an interest in this work.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay. Well, has your research changed the policy at UCSF, if there was a policy about elective induction?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that. So when I came to UCSF 10 years ago, elective induction labor was never practiced. Mm-hmm. And women were expected to manage to 42 weeks of gestational age. And I think primarily because this has been my area of research over the last 10 years, we don't have a policy per se. I mean, each clinician is allowed to make their own decisions on this issue. But I rarely see women get past 41, 41 and a half weeks of gestation. And I have seen the practice of elective induction actually show up.
Mm-hmm. And
because UCSF is a pretty unique labor floor, I mean, again, I think I described to you what usually happens, that women are given cervical ripening agents until their cervix is ripe,
yeah,
as opposed to a dogma about, well, one dose, two dose, three doses.
Mm-hmm.
Because we rarely will call an induction as a failed induction unless someone has gotten into active phase of labor,
mm-hmm,
beyond 5-6 centimeters dilated. We see, and I actually run all the data each month, we rarely see a true failed induction, maybe 1 to 2 per month. And so we haven't seen a bump in the risk of cesarean delivery. In fact, if anything, it's been very stable during a time where the rest of the country, it's been rising, even with these changes in practice.
Hmm. What should clinicians do as a result of the findings you presented in Annals?
Well, my guess is that many clinicians around the country already utilize elective induction. It appears that, in this case, the academic medical centers, particularly UCSF, is behind the practice curve.
Uh-huh.
That the vast majority of private clinicians already utilize elective induction of labor. What I would hope that they would, so I'm not, it's certainly not proselytizing that I would like to see more elective inductions. That's not really what this work is about.
Mm-hmm.
What I think it's about is to say that, look, number one, in the right hands, elective induction of labor, and elective induction of labor more broadly, doesn't appear to increase the risk of cesarean delivery. But that setting, that practice setting that doesn't increase that risk, involves patient management of an induction, which incorporates establishing appropriate expectations from the onset of the induction as opposed to halfway through. And that by counseling women regarding this issue, I think it's likely to, hopefully turn the tide on cesarean delivery we certainly have seen rise dramatically over the past decade. Now, that being said, one other issue that I think clinicians are going to be facing is that if you started doing all these inductions the way that I'm used to doing them, which is waiting, sometimes 2-3 days, what's going to happen on a standard labor floor is that you're going to fill your rooms up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, hospital policy, chiefs of obstetrics, directors of labor and delivery have to kind of strategize about how to do this. I heard a presentation at the Pacific Coast OBGYN Society last year about a group in Seattle that has set up basically a queue for people that want elective induction of labor. So obviously if you have an indicated induction, of course you get delivered. But for women that want, women and their providers who want an elective induction, they get on a backup list. Mm-hmm. And when the labor floor, let's say there's 10 labor rooms, if there's, 4 empty in the morning, they can call one of the elective inductions in.
Hmm.
If by 6 p.m. there's still, 3 rooms empty, they can call another one in. I think this is a really nice way to efficiently run a labor unit where you end up, most labor units we see a surge and then a surge and decline of volume, and staffing is challenging. In this setting, if you have a group of women and providers that would like to utilize elective induction of labor, you're able to fill the spots when they're empty, but you aren't kind of overwhelming the labor unit so that, patients who actually come in spontaneous labor or who have an indicated labor induction aren't being taken care of in suboptimal busy settings like triage or in the hallway.
So you're managing that workflow a bit better.
Exactly.
Well, So I guess the take-home message is a very simple one, if I could abstract it even beyond delivery, and that is talk to the patient and establish expectations with them.
Yes, it's a very simple concept.
Okay. Well, Dr.
I think that Francis Peabody said the art of taking care of the patient is caring for the patient.
Dr. Craig,
exactly
I want to thank you. You're on vacation, and you agreed to come talk with us despite that. So I want to thank you for taking the time out of that, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your vacation, and I look forward to hearing more about your research in this area.
Again, it was my pleasure, and I certainly appreciate your interest in our work.
You can reach us at 1-617-440-4374. With help or suggestions, or you can write to jelia@nejm.org. If you want to listen to earlier podcasts, they're all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all stories can also be found. A reminder, there's no podcast next week. We're all ears at 1-617-440-4374, so give us a ring. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us again in 2 weeks. Enough said.